Members, the House Committee on Elections will come to order. We don't yet have a quorum. We're one member away. But I'd like to start with the bills we have before us. We obviously can't approve the minutes until we have a quorum. We have two bills today. And the first one, let's just go right away with that and get into testimony. It's House File 197, Representative Beard. And any testifiers? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members.
Representative Beard.
Yeah, before you, House File 197, some of you that dealt with elections and government operations last year remember this bill from last year or 2 years ago, but the bill is identical. It's a bill that deals with two things, recounts and the threshold for recounts in state races and legislative races, and the second issue fixes a small quirk in the law that could have prevented a recount because of a person on the ballot who didn't actually want the recount, but the law forced us to recount the ballots. Anyhow, this would allow candidates to opt in instead of requiring governmental units to recount whether the recount was needed or not. To explain that a little more clearly to you, Mr. Chairman and members, I have with me from the Secretary of State's office, Ms. Beth Fraser, and with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn the testimony over to Ms. Fraser.
Ms. Fraser, just introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. And this bill reduces the threshold that would trigger a publicly funded recount for large races. And large is defined as statewide races and congressional races, as well as local races where 50,000 or more votes are cast. So it does not make any changes for legislative races or for small local races. In statewide and congressional races, the proposal is to change the threshold from 0.5% to either 0.25% or 3,000 votes, whichever is less. So 0.5% in this last year's statewide election would have been 14,700 votes. 0.25% would have been 7,300 votes. So in this case, the 3,000 would be less, and that's what would kick in. This would have precluded doing the recount for the gubernatorial race in 2010, but not precluded doing the U.S. Senate recount in 2008. That margin was so small that it would have triggered that recount, even with this lower standard. In the gubernatorial race a few years ago, the vote margin started out at 8,700 votes. And so this, with the 3,000 threshold or even the quarter threshold, would have precluded doing that recount. As Representative Beard said, the other piece of this is that it requires state and federal candidates to submit a written request to have the recount conducted. That's currently the standard in place for local candidates. They have to request the recount. It's paid for if it's within the margin, but it's not automatically done. And in the primary in 2008, there was a recount of a associate justice seat for the Supreme Court, where the top two candidates move on, and the difference between the second candidate and the third candidate was in the 0.5% margin. And so the state and counties conducted the recount, and not a single person showed up to the recount. Not a single person seemed interested in the recount. It didn't seem like a very good use of time or public funds. And so this would just require candidates to submit a written request to have the recount. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And I know that there are some county auditor here as well. Candidates, of course, if the threshold were more than this, would always have the option of requesting the recount and paying for it themselves. So it's not precluding the option of having a recount. The question is who pays if the margin is larger.
Thank you. Ms. Fraser and Representative Beard, we do now have a quorum, so I will move that House File 197 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. So now the bill is properly before us. We'll go to questions. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brazier, a couple questions on your testimony today, just for clarification. You had suggested that this might not affect legislative races. Could it possibly affect a Senate race where we have almost 80,000 persons in a precinct as we start seeing some population shifts? And I know that, well, as a matter of fact, in Representative Beard's district, he had almost that number of people in his House district prior to redistricting. Just wondering if how the process might play at that level.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, the legislation, the language states specifically that a state legislative office is less than 0.5%. So it keeps the 0.5% threshold, regardless of the number of votes cast in a legislative race.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frazier, the legislation talks about ballots cast or voters. And the reason I ask that question is you may get into some school districts here in the state of Minnesota. All in my district, as a matter of fact, and I'm sure is the case in many, there may be multiple school board candidates that are on the ballot. And if you get into an Anoka-Hennepin or a Bloomington or possibly even a St. Cloud areas, that they may have at some point more than 50,000 ballots cast, but some of those come as two or three from an individual voter. In the aggregate, we're talking about that 50,000 threshold, not voters, but ballots cast for candidates, correct?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, perhaps Mr. Gearing can help me with that question.
Mr. Gearing, I don't know if you got the question, and do you care to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the language in the bill specifically refers to calculating the percentage based on the number of the difference between the votes cast for one candidate or the other. So it's based on the number of votes cast in the office. It's not based on the number of voters in the district.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yeah, I'm not opposed at all to the legislation. I'm just wanting to bring up a couple of things that might be embedded in here that we just want to talk about at this level, where you get into some school board races that it might not have been intended, but because of the large number of residents in a district and the ballots cast per voter because of the confines of the tier of candidates that are being elected.
Care to comment, Representative Beard?
I'm just, at first I didn't understand, Representative, Mr. Chair, I didn't understand the question, but I can understand now if there's 30,000 voters and they're each cast voting for three or four candidates, there could be more votes cast because of the number of people on the ballot, the number of votes cast by each balloter, if I could put it that way. So, yes, I think Mr. Gehring's explanation does strike to the fact that it's the number of votes in the race
right.
is what we're looking at here. And the difference between one candidate and the next one is the trigger point, like we had in the judicial race Ms.
Right.
Frazier referenced just a few moments ago.
Representative O'Driscoll, does that satisfy your
Thank you, Mr.
Question?
Chair. It does. I just wanted to simply bring that up as a potential, and that we had at least had a discussion on that as to how that might impact if all of a sudden we start getting, oh, wait a second, as a result of this legislation, we're starting to have to recount some more school board races that we might not have otherwise had to do. This could be part of that reason.
Understood. Ms. Frazier, I have a question for you. How much, maybe you can't, maybe it's not one size fits all, how much does a statewide recount cost?
Mr. Chair and members, in 2010, the state reimbursed the counties for some of their costs, and the state reimbursed the counties for $322,000 in costs. I think that you may hear from the county auditors that did not fully compensate them for the costs they incurred, but they were appreciative that there was some reimbursement.
Well, we do have someone here from A County to testify, Debbie Erickson. Ms. Erickson, just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Debbie Erickson. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers. And I'm here today to tell you that MACO does support the changes in this bill. We are looking to support recommendations for changing the recount process to allow for requiring all candidates to request a recount regardless of where it falls into the threshold. The other piece MACO supports is the intent of the bill to reduce the threshold that triggers an automatic recount, or in this case, a publicly funded recount. As Representative O'Driscoll noted, that the threshold does not currently in this bill take into consideration legislative races. We would be supportive of reducing the threshold to 0.25% for all races throughout the state, whether they are legislative, statewide, or at the local race level as well, with the 3,000 vote difference as the other option there. When we did our presentation to you at the beginning of the session with regard to Elections 101, one of the things that we talked about was the extensive process that is in place for testing before Election Day, the election equipment that is in place. There's a pre-testing process as well as a public testing process that gives every candidate and interested members of the public the opportunity to see that our election equipment counts ballots as the voter has accurately cast them. We feel that the quarter threshold that would be in place to trigger a recount is sufficient for this purpose and could save us a lot of taxpayer dollars as well as administrative time in the process. As Ms. Frazier just noted, in 2010, the difference between the two gubernatorial candidates was about 8,000 ballots, and the state did reimburse the counties for approximately $322,000 worth of expenses. Counties have election judge time, consumable materials, and staff time that goes into conducting a recount at the state level or at any level at that particular process. We feel that by reducing the threshold for election recounts, that this would help to save the taxpayers significant cost when the threshold or the difference between the candidates is significant, and requiring the candidate to request the recount is the proper way to proceed. I would be happy to take any questions.
I have one before I turn to Representative Erdahl. And could you just flesh out a little bit more? My question to Ms. Frazier was, how much does a statewide recount cost? She said that counties had been reimbursed for $322,000 in the 2010 recount, but that probably didn't represent all of the reimbursable costs. Do you have a better sense of what that whole universe would have been? In other words, was the 322 half the cost, three quarters, 90%, something less?
Mr. Chair, I do not have currently with me the entire cost of what all the counties would have incurred for the recount in 2010. I do have Crow Wing County's cost, as that's what I'm familiar with. In our particular instance, we had about 30,000 votes that were cast in Crow Wing County in 2010. During the recount, we used 18 election judges to count those ballots. It took 6.5 hours for the judges to count the ballots by hand in that particular race, and we paid our judges $10 an hour for our costs. We had incurred costs of just over $1,000 for election judge time for that particular purpose. We had three full-time staff at an average wage and benefit level of $32.44 that worked before the election, before the recount, during the recount, and after the recount to finish up all the materials and things that needed to be done, and consumable materials that were in place. In total, we had total costs of about $1,573 for Crow Wing County, and we received $900 in reimbursement from the state.
Okay. So doing very back-of-the-napkin math, I guess you'd say, it was probably, assuming that ratio is right for other counties, which I have no idea if it is, if you do some rounding, it probably costs about, $500,000, let's say. Roughly speaking. So it sounds like what we reimbursed for was over half, but not as much as three quarters. So I'm guessing around $500,000. The reason I ask is just to put an exclamation point on what Ms. Frazier said. Any candidate who comes up short, at least in an initial tally on an election, may have a recount as long as they pay for it. So I'm guessing that the Dayton or Emmer campaigns could have, with a different standard, just said, we're going to raise and spend $500,000, or maybe it's $600,000 or $700,000 to do a recount. So a candidate could do that, and obviously at another level, the cost will be even less, something less than statewide. I just think that's worth emphasizing. The other question I would have, I don't know if Ms. Frazier or anyone else can answer this, when is the last time in Minnesota that there was a recount that wasn't paid for by the public, where a candidate did just that? They were outside of the automatic threshold, but wanted a recount and paid for one nonetheless. I'd be curious to know. I don't know if anyone knows. That's okay. So pretty clearly, almost all of them, at least within memory, are done when they meet that threshold, and we're now seeking to change that threshold, but people always have the other option. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is, I think, for Ms. Frazier, unless Representative Beard knows the answer to this, but I'm guessing that Ms. Frazier might not even know. The question is this, and I don't think anyone has asked it. The threshold between a quarter and a half, that would be the area currently covered but would not be under this legislation. Mm-hmm. Do you have any knowledge or any idea of outcomes that have been recounted and changed that were in that threshold level from a quarter to a half?
Ms. Fraser?
Well, yeah.
Or Representative Beer?
In thinking, Mr. Chairman, and I'll let Ms. Fraser fill in more if there's any coming to her mind, but in Ms. Fraser and I talking about this bill before we brought it to this committee, the last two statewide recounts we had, vote totals moved around 500 votes, which is well under the 3,000 that's recommended here. So yes, there was some change in the statewide count, but the integrity of the voting, once the voter's in the door and cast the ballot, the security and integrity of the system is so good that we've had votes only moved by about 500 votes, both in the Coleman race, Coleman-Franken, and in the Emmer-Dayton race. I can't think of one that's moved substantially more than that in the 20-some years I've been in, 30-some years I've been involved in politics in Minnesota. I myself sat through a recount in the mayor's race 20-some years ago, and out of 3,600 votes counted, we each picked up one vote, and I was very impressed with the integrity of the voting process and the recount process in that. So for votes to move more than a quarter of a percent would be an astonishingly glaring example of incompetence or malfeasance, and I don't think that that's been proven the case anywhere in Minnesota. Ms. Brazier, unless you can think of something beyond that, I can't think of anything where it's been that far off the mark.
Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, the vast majority of the recounts done at the state level have been legislative. And so a few years ago, I did put together some information when the bill originally also changed to the threshold for legislative candidates. And in those races, the votes changed by just a few in each case. And I can pull up that information as well. And one of the local lobbyists came up to me while I was over here and said, you know, we really want one quarter for all races. So, I mean, to put that out there, that, you know, there is interest in making this broader, but, you know, we're trying to make something that will have the most impact, and statewide recounts are really, and large recounts are really the most costly.
I'm sorry, Representative Erdahl, did you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chairman, not really, other than to kind of sum up what you are saying is the intent of your bill, or what would happen is that you don't anticipate that the outcomes would change in any races, but that basically it would save some money and some time and effort.
Ms. Fraser or Representative Beard?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, yes, exactly. Before I agreed to carry the bill, one of the things that we talked about was, if this bill had been the law for the last 10 or 15 years, would any outcome have changed? The answer is no. It wouldn't. All this would have done would have been avoid some recounts that turned out to be unnecessary after the fact.
Representative Erdahl.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Beard. I appreciate that. You understand that for some reason I've grown cautious over some of your bills over the years, and I just wanted to make sure of that.
Zing.
Is there any other members have any comments or questions on this bill? Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Erickson?
Nothing further.
Okay. Any other member comments or questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Anyone? Okay. Seeing no one, I will then renew my motion that House File 197 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. It's on its way to the general register. Thank you, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Ms. Erickson and Ms. Fraser. Okay, now on to the second item of business. Before we do that, just some housekeeping. I don't know if our Vice Chair has had a chance to look over the meeting's minutes of January 31st and whether or not she would move approval.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move approval of our meeting minutes from January 31st.
Okay. The Vice Chair has moved approval of the minutes of January 31st. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, please say no. No. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. We are now on to House File 224, Representative Erickson. We're ready. You and any other testifiers who wish to testify, I know we have on the list Mr. Sulem, and I think Ms. Erickson is coming back for another round here. I will move the bill. Now, members, because there is a fiscal note on this, at least for now, it will have to go to state government finance. So I will move that House File 224 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs. So that's the motion. With that, Representative Erickson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This allows townships or any size of city with 400, the old bill was for 400 registered voters to do a mail-in ballot at their option, and this would allow townships or any size or a city up to 1,000 registered voters, and the key thing is there on may provide balloting by mail, if so it would be of their option. And I think that's pretty much the gist of the bill, and I'll turn it over to...
Okay. Ms. Erickson?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you again. Debbie Erickson representing MACO. MACO supports changes to the mail balloting laws, and this is one of the areas that we feel is very important in this legislative session. We agree with expanding the authority for municipalities to opt to provide for voting by mail and allowing more local control for them to make the best decisions for their municipalities. The thing I'd like to stress the most is that for mail balloting to be successful, election administrators need enhancement to the statewide voter registration system to develop a mail balloting module similar to the absentee ballot module currently in place. Mail balloting is currently a very manual process with no ability for the voter to track their ballot in the system, similar to what you can with an absentee ballot. Appropriation for development of the mail balloting functionality in the statewide voter registration system is essential to ensuring the mail ballot process is a positive one for all voters and cost-effective administratively. This one-time expenditure would greatly enhance the efficiencies in the mail ballot process. And I'd be happy to answer any questions any of the members may have.
Before we go to members, I understand, Mr. Sulem, you want to say a word about this? Just introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem, General Counsel for the Minnesota Association of Townships, and we too are here to offer our strong support for House File 224. This is legislation that we actually tried to pass a few years ago, had very, very strong support. Unfortunately, other politics came into play the last day of session, and it fell by the wayside. And so we're very happy to see it back. It is an important piece for our rural members to have the flexibility. It is not a mandate. It's strictly an option. They still need, their townships would need to work with their county auditors to ensure that it will work in that particular community. I don't think there's any town board that would simply do this if their residents are strongly opposed. It's the case where the residents see this as a cost savings in many areas, as an efficiency issue. It actually has very strong success in turning out, increasing voter turnout and participation. The towns that have done mail balloting, which is very popular in the northern part of the state, where it could be 45 miles to the polling place, that voter turnout has gone up dramatically. And as Mr. Erickson indicated, we also are very supportive of the idea of having a one-time appropriation. We know it's never easy to have extra money around this place, but to bring our election system into the 21st century, make it a little more modern and secure for the efficiency and effectiveness of the administrators and for the voters to know that they can track their ballots. So we think this is an excellent proposal, and we encourage the support of this bill, but keep moving. Thank you.
Mr. Sulem, I have a question before we turn to other members. You and I had some offline discussions about this, and you were educating me about some of your members, and I think I got you right when you said there are some of your member communities and townships that really want to do this. Others, though, that wouldn't take advantage of it, and part of the reason they wouldn't is they want to maintain that polling place for a lot of cultural and other reasons. Could you flesh that out a little bit more about your membership? And I don't know if you've done a poll or anything like that, but no. How popular is it, Mr. Sulem?
this proposal has strong support as long as it remains an option. We certainly do have members. My board president does not support use of mail balloting, but he supports the right to have the option. He believes for his township it's better to have everybody come to the polling place, and they've had that discussion at their township level, and they're maintaining their polling place. But he does support the option to be able to say, if this works in your community, this makes more sense in your area, you should have that right to do what's best for the local community. Like you said, up in Cook County, the three or four townships, the population is so dispersed up there that they went to mail balloting as soon as it became an option several years ago. And we've got communities that are reporting 95% voter turnout with their mail balloting, which is, I think, excellent. We want to encourage participation. Like I said, in those cases, it can be 40, 45 miles to the polling place because they are living in the middle of nowhere. Beautiful country, but they're far away from everything. I'm sure Representative Erickson's district, you have similar situations.
Representative Erickson.
The northwest angle of Lake of the Woods County, when they were having a polling place up there, first of all, a bunch of them live out on the lake, and for them to go vote in November is a very difficult thing for them to do. Plus, then the ballots had to go through Canada to get to Baudette to be counted, which is about a two-hour drive. So it was very problematic in my township, and every place in my county right now except the city of Baudette is mail-in ballots. And I would almost suspect that it might go from 75% to 100% mail-in ballot at their option.
Mr. Chair, if I may flesh out one other point, and that is we do have a few townships. They're doing mail balloting for their March elections, which tend to have slightly smaller turnout. It's a lot more efficient, but they are maintaining the polling place for the state election. That is something they work out with the county as to what's going to be the most efficient and effective overall. But so we do have some that split the use of mail balloting. They do it one way for March elections and the traditional way for November elections. So again, it's the flexibility. It's able to work with their local constituents and their county auditor to see what's going to be the best for the voters and hopefully the most cost efficient.
Representative Dowd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions, and I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I'm a township guy myself and served 6 years on the township board, and actually have worked as an election judge in my own township. So I appreciate and understand what some of these issues are. My question, I think, is for Mr. Sulem. Right now, we allow this in townships with fewer than 400 registered voters. Do you have an idea of out of all the townships in the state, how many is that?
Mr. Chair, works in a doubt. I'd have to get the actual data. My gut feeling, based on the last time I looked at some numbers, is we're probably right around that 50-50 level as far as under 400, over 400. We have obviously several that are very, very small communities, but we also have quite a good cluster that are in that 500 to 2,000 range. So I could certainly research that and have one of our support staff at the office crunch the numbers and get that to you, but I'm guessing you're right around the 50-50 mark.
Representative Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Sulem. I think that's fine. That's kind of all I was wondering, is just a gut feel, but your assumption is it's about maybe half of the townships have fewer than 400 registered voters.
That is, Mr. Chair, that is my estimate. And also for the record, I think the reason that just taking the cap off for townships, the number of townships that exceed 1,000 is very small.
Yep.
And so you'd be excluding a very minor percentage of the townships to have that 1,000 cap. So that's why it made more sense just to lift it completely.
And
White Bear is not likely to go to mail balloting.
And Mr. Sulem, just so I understand, I know that was talked about at one point. I don't know if it was a formal position of your organization, was just to get rid of the cap completely, not put it at 1,000, but get rid of it totally. Am I right about that?
Our position has been to work on the increase in flexibility. We've never had a threshold per se. We've just been trying to move the issue forward. But as the discussions have occurred, I've pointed out that if you're going to set the threshold at 1,000, you'd be excluding so few townships, you're better off just to remove the cap.
I see. Okay. Representative Dowd.
Yeah, thank you. And when I spoke with you, Mr. Chairman, I had actually read the bill wrong. I thought that the cap still applied over 1,000, and the legislation reads that it's townships of any size or a city with fewer than 1,000 registered voters. So my mistake when I read it the first time. The next question, Mr. Sulem, what do you know out of, if we're talking about half the townships in the state that would qualify for this, do you know how many are actually utilizing it? Or maybe that's a better question for Ms. Frazier from the Secretary of State's office. Do you know about how many townships are actually
Mr. Chair, fall under that? I do not. I don't know if the Secretary has that data.
As Ms. Frazier was coming up, I know, because this came up in another context, totally different from this recently, I think the number, this doesn't answer your question, but it's maybe helpful to it. I think the total number of voters in the whole state of Minnesota who vote this way it's about 46,000 is my recollection. But Ms. Frazier, maybe you have updated numbers.
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Frazier from the Office of the Secretary of State. And I believe there are between 500 and 600 townships that use all-mail balloting.
Okay. And I probably should know this, Mr. Chairman. How many townships in the state?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sulem?
I guess I'll go to my knees.
You should know, right?
1,784.
I was about to guess, and I'm glad I didn't, because I would have been way off. So maybe half of the townships now that I'm just doing back in the napkin math here, about half of the townships that would qualify to do this are maybe taking advantage of it right now. Is that right?
As I read
based
it,
on
just what I jotted down was 500 to 600 townships use it, and there are 1,784.
But about half of those would qualify for it right now?
Oh.
And only half of those then are using it?
Mr. Chair,
about right?
Members, Representative Dowd, between 500 and 600 is probably jurisdiction. So that probably includes some small cities as well.
Oh.
So that probably overstates the township use.
Okay. Those are all good questions.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just, you know, trying to wrap my mind around it. So, yeah, that was it. But thank you.
Okay. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you don't mind, Mr. Gehring, my first question would be for you. I know that line 1.6, we're striking municipality and then inserting township of any size or a city. Can you give me the legal distinction between those three jurisdictions? And I also ask that because I know, notice in line 1.13, we use the phrase municipality again. So I just want to make sure that I legally understand what we're doing here in this bill.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, I don't think there is necessarily a legal distinction between using municipality and township and city in line 1.6. I think the reason there is just that you're differentiating now between any size township and cities with a certain population. And then on 1.13, I think the use of municipality there works because it would refer to either towns or cities designating a particular precinct in their jurisdiction.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, Mr. Sanders.
To that point, municipality and election law does include cities and towns, but because of the population, it makes sense. But if I may, Mr. Gehring, am I correct? We, in casual conversation, we use the term township. For statutory purposes, I believe that should say town. That drafting would say a town of any size versus township.
Mr. Gehring?
The legal entity in the state of Minnesota is town. Township is what we refer to them. It's the casual conversation. But the legal designation, when you look at other statute, is the town of. So I believe on that line, township should be struck in the word town inserted. I apologize for not catching that earlier, but...
Okay. In terms of handling that issue, it sounds like, well, Mr. Gehring, you say it's not clear, or...
Mr. Chair, I guess I would defer to Mr. Sulem. I guess
okay.
I don't know the distinction. So.
Well, Mr. Sulem, I tend to defer to your experience as well. If that would make you feel more comfortable, I think we could entertain that as a...
In terms of legal entity, yes. We the legal entity is town.
Okay. Well, then, to this point, Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to strike... SHIP on line 1.6.
Could you clarify one more time what that was?
All right. Does everyone have that, Mr. Gehring? Everyone else? Is that clear? Very carefully stated, Representative Wayne. Any comments to that oral amendment? Any comments to that oral amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the Winkler Amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted. Okay.
Mr.
Chair? Representative Winkler.
Just to follow up on that previous discussion, Mr. Gehring, you can... We may disagree. It's my understanding that municipality also includes school districts. And I know that because I used that to pass a bill that Representative Greiling really hated one year related to schools by using the word municipality. So I'm concerned that by switching it to townships and cities, we're excluding school districts.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. That's what I was trying to get at, is what jurisdictions are going to fall in or out of changing the words. And you know, part of me says if a municipality covers all that, then why are we making a legal distinction or a legal change in the law or statute anyway?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Fraser.
Election law has its own definitions, and Chapter 200 defines the terms for the rest of the election sections, and we believe that Chapter 200 defines municipality to mean city or town, not township or school district.
Mr. Gehring,
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that's correct. So there's a definition in Chapter 200 that says, for purposes of election law, a municipality is a city or town, period. And in other chapters of statute, it may be defined differently, but for election purposes, it's cities and towns.
You've added to my Phyllis Kahn-like repertoire of distinctions that can be used later, Mr. Gehring.
Representative Winkler.
But then the question is, why are we then changing the language there?
Ms. Fraser, I'm going to pick on you for that one. Why not just leave it as municipality?
Mr. Chair?
I Mr. Sulem, too, but wait, I understand the distinction about a township of any size, regardless of number of voters, or a city having fewer than one. So, in other words, I understand that distinction, but are we just better off going back to municipality regardless? Mr. Sulem?
Mr. Chair, members, it is that distinction because you're lifting the cap completely for towns. And again, the rationale for that is that you have very few towns that exceed the 1,000 threshold. Whereas you probably still have several hundred cities that exceed. So if you were to leave it as municipality, you essentially would be saying the city of Minneapolis could go to mail balloting. And that's the need for the distinction, that a town of any size is covering our membership, but at the city level you have a much broader population threshold. And so the 1,000 protects or creates that distinction for the truly small cities versus the larger.
Representative Verdol, you were on the list before. I don't think it was to this issue. Is it? So we'll wait. Representative O'Driscoll, to this issue.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we want to, from my quick read on the statute, it does not define town separately. It does define municipality being city and town. If we wanted to do the differentiation between city and town, we may end up having to add an additional definition to Chapter 200 to separate those, if that's the intention of the committee, to allow all towns or townships to have this right, and then cities or municipalities, quote unquote cities, of 1,000 or less.
So, Representative O'Driscoll, you're saying we should leave it as it is or not?
Well, I'm not legal counsel for this particular committee, but my quick read again of the statute says municipality is defined as city and town. And we may end up having to define city separately and town separately in the definitions in 200 to be able to accomplish a town of any size having this privilege and a city of 1,000 or less.
Mr. Chair?
In that case, Representative Driscoll, that seems to counsel in favor of leaving the bill language as it is with the Winkler Amendment. That's how I read what you're saying. Representative O'Driscoll?
No, because that goes to the point of what Mr. Sulem said, that the city of Minneapolis then would have the ability to do mail-in ballots because the definition of municipality in 200 is cities and towns.
Mr. Chair, if I may clarify.
Mr. Sulem.
What I say, if you left that municipality, if you left current law, that's where you would be creating the trouble. By creating the distinction here, a town and a city are legal entities created by state law. They are recognized, filed with the Secretary of State as legal entities. So you don't need that definition. You do want, the bill as drafted and amended is the way that draws the proper distinction between my members, where you don't need to worry about the population threshold, and city government. And again, those forms of government are well-established, created. You know, we've got chapters 365 for townships, 410 and 412 for cities that establish what they are as legal entities. So there wouldn't need to be a separate definition in 200, but if you don't do the bill as drafted, then you're making the umbrella too big.
Okay, I think I do understand that. I just want to address the city of Minneapolis issue because I understood it before, but not as it's been used most recently. So as I see this subdivision of current law, it really does two things. One is that the entire boundary of the municipality may do certain things, and then a separate part of what the subdivision says is regardless of the size of that municipality, if there's a precinct within that municipality having fewer than X, in the case of current law, 50, but in the case of the law's proposed 100 registered voters, no matter the size. So if Minneapolis had a precinct that had fewer than 100 voters, arguably under this, Minneapolis, for that one precinct only, could do this. So really we're amending both portions of that
Mr.
here.
Mr. Chair.
Is that right, Mr. Sulem?
I believe you're correct. And just to clarify also, this whole provision only applies outside the metro area. So I apologize. When I mentioned Minneapolis, I was referring to population. I wasn't thinking the geographical area, because this whole law has and continues to apply only outside the metropolitan area.
And actually, that's good, because and I hadn't stepped back and looked at the whole section of statute.
I was just trying to explain why you didn't want to leave municipality. You want it as drafted,
right.
So you have the clear distinction.
Yeah, the intention, obviously, Representative Erickson and others, is not for this to be a metropolitan area phenomenon.
Absolutely.
It's for those who really need it and use it. Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the first part of the bill, or the first few sentences of the paragraph, apply only outside of the metro area. So the talking about jurisdictions, any size town or cities with more than 1,000. The last sentence, in terms of small precincts, applies anywhere in the state.
So, Ms. Fraser, are there examples of metro area precincts? Obviously not municipalities. Given what you just said, and I think you may be right, are there examples of metro area precincts? Is there an example of a Hennepin County precinct that uses this? Do you know, Ms. Fraser?
Mr. Chair, I believe that there are precincts in the metro area that use mail balloting.
Okay.
I don't know if there are any actually in a core city, but I know that there are precincts in the 7 or 11 county metro area.
Ms. Erickson, you seem to be nodding. Is that your understanding as well?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is my understanding, that there are some counties in the metro area that do have small precincts under the 50 voters right now that are using mail ballot.
Okay, so we've isolated the two things that the bill really does. It sounds like the second thing, the smaller precincts, can happen in the metro, but explicitly, as we see on line 1.8, it can't happen in for an entire jurisdiction unless it's a non-metropolitan county. That's how I understand it. Is that correct, Ms. Fraser?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It would also allow it to be used in small precincts in jurisdictions out in greater Minnesota, too, but
yes,
that are larger than that threshold.
Of course. So, for example, Ms. Fraser, if there were in Moorhead or in Bemidji or in Duluth a precinct that were fewer than 50 people, they could use that as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
As could Minneapolis, theoretically.
Yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Got it. Okay. Any other? Oh, Representative Erdahl was next. He appears to have left. Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and so maybe I don't suppose Roger cares much about this. Maybe Representative Erickson, maybe he does. But why are we going from 50 to 100 on the individual precincts?
Ms. Erickson or Ms. Fraser? Or Ms. Erickson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, maybe I can shed a little light there. The requirements in law currently say you have to have two pieces of equipment and four election judges in every precinct for a regular election. Those start to add up to costs. If you have fewer than 100 voters, perhaps that's what the tipping point is and what the cost-effective balance might be for a turnout of 20, 30, 40 voters versus a turnout of 120 voters. It might be more cost-effective for a municipality to have either a, if it's possible, a combined precinct or in other circumstances to do mail voting in those particular smaller jurisdictions.
Ms. Erickson, a follow-up before I go back to Representative Wickler. Could you repeat that standard again? How many per precinct? What has to be in every precinct?
You're required to have at least four election judges and two pieces of equipment, a vote tabulator and an automark assisted voting device in every precinct.
So right now, Ms. Erickson, if there are 51, under current law, if there are 51 registered voters in a precinct, you have to have all that stuff in there?
Mr. Chair, if there are 15 registered voters in a precinct, you would have to have all that stuff if you're choosing to have an election at the polling location.
Of course.
If it's within greater Minnesota outside of the 7-county metro area, you could choose to do mail balloting if you have 51. If you choose to have a polling location for whatever size, you would have to have those requirements.
Got it. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just trying to visualize where this happens in the metro area. It seems to me that the voters in that district don't really have a say in what precinct boundaries or how precinct boundaries are drawn, and some people may end up, you know, for cost effectiveness reasons, being sent to mail balloting, and they're, you know, may not be any particular distance or any other inconvenience for them to go to a polling place. So I just, you know, as a practical matter, are we creating more mail-in balloting for people just to save money when it's, you know, when combining precincts would be a more efficient way to do it?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, in case it's helpful, I brought a map of where mail balloting is actually used in Minnesota currently, and we can hand that out. And in the metro area, it looks like it's only been used in Wright and McLeod counties. And so it hasn't been used more broadly than that in the metro area. Decisions about polling places or going to mail balloting have to be made at the municipal level, and so it would take an action of the city council or the town board, and so local residents would have the opportunity to weigh in on that decision.
Representative Winkler?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't have a problem changing that number. It's, you know, because large parts of McLeod and Wright are way more rural in character than they are metropolitan. They fit the definition in statute, but they're not part of the core metropolitan county. So you're not really probably changing, making a difference for people who just happen to be drawn into a small precinct and otherwise are part of the city of Columbia Heights or something like that. So I'm fine with that.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess for anybody at the testimony table, I know Representative Dow asked about how many townships this would capture. How many cities would this capture, now that we are explicitly calling them out here? How many cities would this expansion capture?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, I don't know. I can find out that information, but I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I think we can pull it up.
Okay. Just introduce yourself for the record. And
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Lindstrom. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. And I just have some information that I pulled up for prior bills that we've looked at. But there are 853 cities in the state of Minnesota, and 506 cities have a population under 1,000. So that's 60% of cities in Minnesota.
Okay. That was a succinct answer. And very precise. Okay, so we're talking about 506 out of 1,000 plus, 60%. Okay. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Ms. Frazier, Mr. Solomon, is this, I know you had said that you have a township that uses mail balloting for their March elections, and then for the general election, they're using
regular polling place. Is this an all-or-nothing proposition? You're either a mail-in ballot city or town, or you have a polling place. Is this an all-or-nothing proposition?
Mr. Sewell?
Mr. Chair, the flexibility is not being changed. So those who want to do it for both would be able to do it for both. Those who have worked out with the county to do it for March, a polling place in November, could still do that. That's a local decision that is not being modified in any way by this bill.
So, Mr. Chair, if I understand that right, so if you have one of these 506 cities, if they so choose, could both have a polling place and also do mail-in balloting for those, for anyone that choose to participate through a mail-in ballot, or do you have to choose, would that city choose up front, we're mail-in balloting, or we're having a polling place?
Well, Mr. Chair, Robertson Saunders, let me try to distinguish a couple of things. One, at the town level, we're the only ones who do March elections. So the cities are strictly November elections.
Yes,
as far as if they're using mail balloting, with the possible exception of the small precincts, you either would have the city would be either mail balloting or polling place, with the possible exception of the handful of communities that are using that under 50 and proposed under 100 for an individual precinct. But I think Ms. Erickson may be able to clarify that even more.
And I am talking about the general election, Mr. Chair.
The general election, okay.
Is this an all-or-nothing proposition in a general election for, you know, if this law went into effect and a city or a township qualified, do they need to decide up front, are we going to be doing mail-in balloting or operate a precinct polling place, or do they have a combination option of doing whichever?
Ms. Erickson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, yes, it is up front. The municipality, the city, or the town board does take action to apply to conduct mail balloting for all, if it's a general election, for their entire precinct, for their entire municipality. So there's not an option for the voter to choose whether or not it is a mail precinct or a polling location. They either do entire mail balloting or they have a polling location.
Representative
Mr. Chair, if I may just clarify, with very, very limited exceptions, because some of the redistricting lines, I'd say 99% of townships are single precinct, so it would be covered either way.
And Mr. Chair, if I may add one more thing, Representative Sanders, a mail ballot precinct, a city or township who chooses to do mail ballot, the county auditor's office continues to be a polling location for those residents within that municipality. So they can still come to the auditor's office and vote on election day at a polling place if they wish to do so. It's similar to an absentee process at that time.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of other style of elections, since we talked about the March township election. If we have a special election and or school district referendum elections, would these be affected by this statutory change?
Mr. Sewell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, if it were a special election for an elected seat, you would be treating it, you know, you'd have the mail balloting option as part of your election process. When you get to, say, a bond referendum or a question on election, that is covered by a separate statute that authorizes mail balloting for election questions. But if you're talking about a special election to fill a vacancy on the town board, that is governed by election law, and so this would apply to that as well. But if you're dealing with a ballot question for, say, a bond referendum of some sort, that is a separate area of law not covered by this bill.
Representative Driscoll, anything else? Representative Erdahl?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had another comment I was going to make earlier, but that one's time has passed. So I will just relay for what it's worth. I just had a conversation out in the hall with the mayor of the city of Darwin. 350 people, home of the largest wall of twine made by one man. And the mayor just said that, you know, he felt that the people of his town, if they wanted to vote, had the opportunity to get absentee ballots. Or there should be a little bit of effort in voting, and they should show up at the polling place and vote. So again, for whatever it's worth, I'm conveying the feelings of the mayor of Darwin that this is not such a good idea.
Although, Representative Erdahl, you noted that there was a population of 350, so even under current law, he and his township or town would already have the option of doing this. I mean, even if we do nothing today, so. But yeah, it's an interesting opinion. What? Any other comments or questions? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, one other question comes to mind since we've discussed some of this as relates to absentee balloting and others. How would an individual, just for the committee's benefit, be able to retract a mail-in ballot if they've changed their mind or would like to cast that ballot in a different fashion or for other candidates? And then on that same tone, would the information of an individual who has cast a ballot using a mail ballot be kept confidential so that that would the integrity of the process would be maintained?
Okay. Ms. Erickson, so the clawback question and then ballot integrity.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, a mail ballot process is similar to what the absentee process currently is. So mail ballots are returned to the county auditor's office and are kept secure until 5 o'clock on the Friday prior to election day, at which point in time they are then opened and processed like an absentee ballot. So the voter has until that threshold or until that time frame to request to have their ballot returned or to claw it back, basically saying they spoiled their ballot and wish to change their vote. Keep in mind, again, because this is a manual process, it's a little bit more involved. There's not a way, an easy way, for that voter to have access to know whether their ballot has already been accepted, returned, or rejected by the board unless they've already received a letter, because we don't have that module in place. The second part of the question, as far as the confidentiality of the ballots and how it's kept secure, same as with the absentee process, they're all kept under lock and key. The ballots are sealed into envelopes starting that Friday before at 5 o'clock that Friday when they can begun to be opened and processed. The ones that are fed through the tabulator are taken out, sealed on a given day's basis, and kept under lock and key until such time as the election results are public.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Ms. Erickson, the cost of doing this for counties across the state of Minnesota, where 60% of municipalities could be eligible and a large number of our towns being eligible. As a chief election official in Crow Wing County, how do you see your workload being modified as a result of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that's a great question. In 2012, Crow Wing County has 64 precincts. We have 10 that vote exclusively by mail, and they range anywhere in size from 35 voters to 165 voters are the size of the precincts in our county that have chosen to go with mail balloting. Our total costs that we charge back to the municipalities include costs for their postage. We pay outgoing and return postage on every mail ballot that goes out. We charge them back for the envelope costs of actually mailing the ballots to the different voters in their precincts. And in our county, we also charge for election judge training and processing time for judges that are devoted exclusively to the mail ballot process. We determine that's approximately 7 judges who work exclusively with the mail ballots. In 2012, we had total costs charged back of $4,842 to the cities and townships. So it makes sense for a city or a town that has a small number of voters that they can save the $10, $12 an hour that they're paying an election judge, that they're paying for the equipment in their polling place, that they're paying for utilities at their town hall, whatever it might be, to pay for a few thousand dollars or $1,000 or so. If you have a municipality that has 1,000 voters or 500-600 voters, it might not be necessarily as feasible for them to be able to do so. It costs 65 cents each way for postage to send a ballot back and forth. So it does increase the cost for a municipality once it hits a certain tipping point of what it is, whether it is beneficial for them to do mail balloting or not, but at least the option is there for them to do so. Administratively, what additional work would be required at the election official end? If there is no change made to the statewide voter registration system to allow for more automatic processing of mail ballots, it will increase our administrative efforts significantly if a larger number of precincts go to mail ballot.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if there's been a fiscal note then that has been requested on this, but there may well be as a result of a need for one based on the testimony provided to us by Ms. Erickson on this.
I'm sorry. Oh, Ms. Fraser? I'm sorry, I was just conferring with Representative Sanders. Oh, right. I'm sorry. We were talking about fiscal notes. Yeah, there has not been one requested, as I understand it. There will be one because there is an appropriation in
Mr.
the bill.
Chair?
This is why it's going to State Government Finance. Mr. Sewell?
If I may just add one point to Representative Driscoll's question, and that is, you know, when you get to that tipping point or the administrative cost to a county, current law and what would remain law is that if it didn't work at the county level, they would be able to still say, no, you cannot go to mail balloting. So it is strictly a locally decided cost-benefit analysis that occurs between the township and the county as to this is what our cost would be, here's what you'd have to pay, versus here's our administrative expense. So, you know, any additional local expense would be by local choice.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, with 60%, that's the part that sticks in my mind. I realize that Mr. Sulem represents townships, and we had someone who had inserted some stuff from the league, but having a municipal background, I always just kind of put it in the context of that. 60% of municipalities may be interested in participating in something like this under the proposed legislation. I'm wondering if we don't create a problem with the way it is without fleshing this out a little bit more and hearing from the cities as to what they say on a more in-depth basis.
Ms. Erickson?
Mr. Chair, members, there is also a provision if a municipality chooses to do mail balloting and decides it does not work out for them, they can always revert back to having a polling location as well. So even though it's all or nothing for a particular election cycle, they do have the authority to make that change, again, in conjunction with the county auditors to make sure that that is workable on both sides, that they can revert from being an exclusive mail ballot precinct to going back to having a polling location. So it can go either way.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I think this will be my final comment. I'm not opposed to the idea. I'm just concerned with the evidence that and information that we've received today to have a chance to digest this. We may be fixing something that is or isn't a problem today, but by making this fix, we may create some bigger problems tomorrow. We're pitting counties and cities and townships against one another for who's going to be responsible for this and why can't we have it in our city or our town. And we may have others that are coming back to the legislature wanting to modify the law. Let's measure twice, cut once on something like this. And so my suggestion would be that we lay it over, collect some more information, and maybe even invite others in who can weigh in on this when it's going to affect potentially 60% of cities and a large number of townships.
You know, I'm looking to Ms. Lindstrom on this in terms of the league. I don't know what formal position. I know Mr. Sulem's organization and the townships have taken a position. I actually confess I don't know or remember if the league has a position or if now or later you or someone else from the league would be prepared to testify or provide us with materials on the position of the cities.
Mr. Chair and members, again, I'm Ann Linzer for the League of Minnesota Cities. We don't have an official position on this bill. I would be more than happy to work with people to develop a formal position, but to everything that was spoken here, it supports our general position of having local control, and especially with the cities and the counties working together to figure out what's going to be in the best interest and what's most cost-effective for our cities in administering their elections. So, in general, I would say that this is something that the league would be in support of, though we have not developed an official position on that.
Okay. I want to bring up another Representative Driscoll. Anything else? I want to bring up an issue that Representative Sanders just communicated to me, and I hadn't connected these dots yet. He has. Which is the relationship between this bill and the bill that we heard recently, the bill that I'm carrying about no excuses absentee. And I'd like to ask Ms. Erickson in particular, since I don't know that she'll be able to be here on short notice if we were to take this up again as soon as Thursday, I'm wondering if, and this is a very broad question, if you could speak to, I don't want to speak for Representative Sanders, but as we were talking before, the interplay between those two. In other words, if we did go to a system of no excuses absentee, would a bill like this still be necessary, not necessary, advisable? Are there still townships, in your judgment, that would opt for this even with a no-excuses absentee?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Erickson.
Members, While mail balloting and absentee voting do somewhat go hand in hand, there is distinct differences between the two. And a no-excuse absentee bill really doesn't affect a mail balloting process from the standpoint that it is the decision of the city or the township whether they choose to conduct their election exclusively by mail. It is the decision of the individual voter whether they choose to request an absentee ballot. So the absentee, the no-excuse absentee, doesn't automatically send an absentee ballot to every resident within the entire city or township, whereas this particular process, the mail ballot process, does. If a municipality has chosen to go exclusively mail ballot, there's no application process that a voter has to go through to get a ballot. They are mailed a ballot if they are registered to vote. They are automatically mailed a ballot. If they are not registered to vote, there's a process where they can contact our office to get an application, basically, to get a mail ballot at that point in time. While the processing of both mail ballots and absentee ballots is similar and goes hand in hand, the actual administration of them is a slightly different process, and the two bills should not have any direct correlation to each other.
Okay. Representative Anders, I was paraphrasing you, and maybe I didn't do it well, or maybe I did. Do you want to add anything to that about what your questions were? About
thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that there may be some possibilities in discussing it. Obviously, it's up to you, and we would need the feedback. It's just something that kind of popped into my mind, understanding absolutely everything you just said about the differences. Hypothetically, if we were to move to the no-excuse absentee balloting system, and we were able to work out agreements on that, in those areas where folks, municipalities, cities that would qualify, towns that would qualify under this type of legislation, would be able to be, I know that you had in your current bill, the permanent absentee ballot status, basically, where those folks would be on that list and would be automatically mailed a ballot once they had applied. So in that scenario, that could be a clause that we may be able to support since mail-in balloting is already happening, and since I believe Ms. Fraser, and I could be wrong, but absentee ballots are already in the SVRS system.
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, yes, there is already a module in the
Mr. Chair, Sanders. This is literally, throwing it on the wall and see what sticks type of a thing, but if we're able to talk about this more offline, is seeing, is there a more economical way to do it? Is there a more efficient way to do it if we were to kind of combine the two systems and see if it would work, especially since that module already exists in the SVRS system? But again, I would support, not trying to in any way submarine the bill, but if we could discuss this more and think about this more, digest this more, maybe have that conversation and just see if it's something that could work. I do see this. I don't have, this doesn't apply to any jurisdiction that I currently represent, but it seems to be somewhat of a substantial change, especially when most of our towns and 60% of our cities would qualify, that maybe we could combine these two efforts.
Ms. Fraser, before I get to you, I just want to say that I'm thinking about savings to municipalities, and I'm thinking about the situation of a township or a city that has, let's say, 200 voters. I'll pick a random number. And let's say we did have no excuses, so the actual number of voters intending to go into a polling place is even fewer. Let's say a quarter of the 200 voters decide to do no excuses absentee, leaving 150 who then vote in the precinct. I can see a municipality saying at that point, wow, we've now gone from 200 voters to 150 who regularly go to the actual place. We really want to do this all by mail. So they might actually work in concert with one another, or one might inform the choices of a municipality in that way. I don't know if those numbers would ever bear out, but I think that's one possibility. So I am inclined then to lay this over, particularly since we already having laid over my bill for no excuses absentee voting. Maybe we could take them up, maybe even together, as soon as this Thursday, but if not, then pretty quickly in succession. I did want to, before I, Ms. Fraser, you had a comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's along those same lines. I think that just going to no excuse absentee without making changes to mail balloting could really impact local jurisdictions financially. Because if, for example, you have a city that has 700 registered voters, they would, under current law, not be eligible to use mail balloting. If we go to no excuse absentee voting, if 500 of those voters do no excuse absentee voting, they have to process all of those absentee ballots and still have to run a polling place that at this point only up to 200 voters may show up to. And so I think that it makes sense to look at raising the cap in that case so that jurisdictions can decide what's best for their voters, and that if voters are choosing to vote by mail, that they could go to all mail.
Okay. One other housekeeping point, members, and I think we can get out of here a little bit early. Mr. Gehring has discovered one change that I think we need to make the bill just grammatically consistent. So, Mr. Gehring, do you want to mention that? Oh, okay. Well, why don't we do this? We don't have to do it by amendment today, but just so the public knows, could you just describe it? And then when we take it up after we lay it over, we can do it by formal amendment. But, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's just a sort of grammatical clarification that might be helpful for the bill, just to clarify the intent. Current law provides that municipalities that are not located within a metropolitan county are eligible for mail balloting, and with the addition of the township and city distinction, the grammar of the sentence doesn't make clear whether the requirement applies to both cities and towns that exist outside of the metropolitan counties, or just cities that apply outside of the metropolitan counties. So it would be a fairly simple grammatical fix to clarify that you're covering both types of jurisdictions. But if the bill is being laid over, I could draft
right.
it up and
great.
We can see.
We'll just do that. Members, any other comments? We'll lay this bill over. Thanks for your patience, Representative Erickson. But I think it's because we want to do it right and we want to be as unified as we can here. But it sounds like there's an appetite to do something, generally speaking. So any other comments from members? Questions? Concerns? Okay. We will be meeting Thursday, and we will take up again, and we'll have some offline discussions, but we'll take up again for discussion the No Excuses Absentee Voting Bill. We may or may not be taking this up again. I'm not sure whether under House rules we can, but we'll take it up at some other point as well. So if there are no other comments or questions, the meeting is adjourned.